This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider. 6 Feet Under was one of the shows that ushered in the new golden age of TV. And for Portlandia co-creator and star Carrie Brownstein, it also produced one of her favorite episodes of TV of all time, the season 4 episode, That's My Dog.
6 Feet Under will always be a show that I'm fond of for many reasons. One is that it's the first show that I binge-watched. I didn't have HBO at the time. I rented... maybe even VHS.
Yeah. Like from Blockbuster?
From Blockbuster, something like that.
Yeah.
And sort of watched it like that, which feels very analog. And but it was the first show that I sort of consumed in this way that by the time it ended, I felt like all these people were my family and I missed them.
Yeah.
At the end, you know, like by Nate, you know, I just...
Right.
But this episode, I think in particular, I guess what I like about it is that it took huge risks with their audience. Like, and I think as someone who makes television, you know, taking that kind of risk, I see it now as a precedent that other people have done, where they take, you know, sort of the audience's expectations and they subvert them. And I don't think in this case it was manipulative. I think it was really trying to get at something flawed and contradictory about the character.
Yeah.
And sort of trying to, you know, expose, I guess, the vulnerabilities and also just the sort of the dark underpinnings and the sort of like the urges, the sort of abject urges that we all have, and taking a character that people love and sort of messing with them, I think, is something that is hard to do. I thought it was a really intense episode, and it sticks in my mind, and I think not in a bad way.
So I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the podcast, we talked to Carrie Brownstein about 6 Feet Under, and also her favorite episode of a comedy of all time, plus her favorite episode of Portlandia ever. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode's about to start.
'Cause you're my favorite episode.
My favorite episode.
Coming real, it's the next episode. Episode.
IFC's Portlandia returned for an 8th and final season this past winter, as fans said farewell to the eclectic Portland-based characters played by stars and co-creators Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein. Armisen, Brownstein, and Jonathan Kreisel were behind the long-running show, which is up for several Emmys this year, including Outstanding Variety Sketch Series and Outstanding Directing for a Variety Series, which Brownstein is nominated for as the helmer behind the episode Riot Spray. IndieWire recently sat down with Carrie Brownstein to discuss the legacy of Portlandia and whether she and Fred might ever be interested in revisiting the show. We also talked about the state of her Hulu pilot, Search and Destroy, and what she has in store next. But first, we dug into that 6 Feet Under episode and how it was one of the shows she at first missed out on while touring with her band, Sleater-Kinney. I first wanted to ask you about the 6 Feet Under episode. The episode that you chose, That's My Dog,
mm-hmm.
So it's season 4, episode 5 from July 18, 2004. This was like a departure episode for 6 Feet Under.
It was a departure episode. So you take sort of the most humanist, relatable character, sort of the moral center of the show.
Yeah.
David Fisher. And they thrust him into a really terrifying, violent scenario where he is sort of tricked and attacked and beaten. And it's horrific.
It's brutal.
It's a brutal episode. And I think people were kind of all over the place with their reactions to it. I think some people thought it was a brave and interesting episode, and other people thought it was gratuitous and its violence, and that they were taking, you know, their gay character and sort of punishing him. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
there was a lot of reactions, all valid.
Yeah, it was, and I think part of it is because, you know, this was still 2004, so mm-hmm. this was like the early days of the quote-unquote new golden age of mm-hmm. TV, mm-hmm. so you could still kind of get away with really shocking people. This was still kind of completely out of the norm and not what people were expecting, where maybe these days they expect things a little bit more because, you know, 15, 20 years later, there are so many shows that do this sort of, you know, left turn all mm-hmm. of a sudden and do these shocking episodes that it might be less shocking today than it was back then. But mm-hmm. to take especially this character that people sort of took for granted mm-hmm. to some degree, including mm-hmm. the other characters on the show, mm-hmm. and just to torture him like that and to put him through that was... That was a hard watch.
Yeah, and I think a show that, like, so, you know, the premise was so much about mortality, mm-hmm. and you never want, you know, it always started, each episode started with a death. And yeah. I feel like in terms of violence, you never want violence to feel quaint. You know what I mean? And I think there was something when you're dealing with death, and some of the deaths at the beginning were violent and, or, you know, even sometimes played for laughs. And I also think it was a way for people to remind themselves not to be inured to violence. You know yeah. what I mean? That it came in as kind of this reminder of the real brutality and messiness of life. And also that, you know, violence is not something that we should get used to. And I think it came in a show that sometimes people thought was, could be too facile and too sort of arch in certain ways.
Yeah.
And yeah. And people so come it's, in here, I guess, one of my favorite shows.
Sick, yeah. It's and you mentioned it, you know, at the time, maybe, and I think probably still even now, people are sort of bothered perhaps by the fact that, you know, it was a gay character and he was put through the ringer like this. And I know even back then, Alan Ball, the creator of the show, and Alan Poole, who directed the episode, they're both gay men. So they both sort of had an interesting sort of statement on that, which is that's not what we were trying to do here. And, you know, they were able to perhaps, you know, go down that road because they had something more to say than to just torture their gay character and make it be a punishment. That's not what they wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like that to me upon watching it. And also, I feel like because David Fisher was a sort of an early gay character, like in sort of, you know, it was not as common to have sort of a fully realized, fully actualized gay character. You know, he had a partner, and it was like there was something sort of sanitized yeah. about it. They sort of, I feel like, had to sort of purposely, like, sanitize these characters for a while. He had to sort of be like the, you know, the hold up the moral rectitude of the show because people sort of expected him, you know, to be subversive. And so when they messed with that, I thought that they were taking, you know, some bold moves there, in terms of, like, depiction of, I don't know, of queerness and sort of the multitudes, and that it wasn't just, you wasn't going to be safe for everyone. I thought it was actually kind of a reminder, like, you know, don't take this for granted.
Yeah, yeah. And it turns out he was a serial killer in Miami anyway all this time, so...
There we go. I mean, yeah, I like to conflate all of my characters, so yeah.
yeah.
It was actually, they were doing a great thing. It was like, you know, they caught Dexter early.
Had no idea
at the time. You're right, yeah. If they'd gotten rid of David Fisher, we never would have had all the murders that Dexter would have, you know,
yeah.
wrought upon people.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's how TV works, that right?
I think so.
Yeah, okay,
I think
good.
So. So take me back. So you didn't watch it at the time. You watched it a couple years later?
Yeah, a couple years later. So still, like, maybe the late 2000,
yeah.
you know, 2008, 2009.
Because early 2000s was still sort of the height of Sleater-Kinney, right? And you were probably busy touring, and did you have much time to watch TV back when you were on the road all the time?
No, I didn't have a lot of time to watch TV. I remember touring when I was just out of college, and we were playing a lot of other colleges at the time because it was a way to make money. You would go and play, like, Yale or Dartmouth, and it was like a decent guarantee, financial guarantee at the time. And walking in, we had to stay in someone's dorm, and everyone was sitting around watching the show. and it was Friends, and I was like, I never even heard of it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh God. And I was like, oh yeah, Friends. I missed a lot of shows because I was touring, lots of television shows because I was touring.
Is there ever a weird gap where someone brings up like a 90s show and you're like, no idea?
I missed Frasier. Yeah, there's a couple gaps, I think. Will and Grace, Frasier. I managed to catch most of Seinfeld. I think I have it more with music, like popular music at the time. Like, I just did not listen to any mainstream music.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird, though. But that was a time where you could actually tune things out. Like, you could miss things. It's a lot harder to miss things now.
Right.
I think people actually wish they were missing certain things. Like, there used to be sort of FOMO. You know, that acronym of fear of missing out. And now I think people are like, I wish there was some event that happened without my knowing it.
Right, right. You even know? Memes. Like, you're kind of up to speed on the memes.
Yeah.
And yeah, so. Well, the other show that you brought up is The Office. Now, mm-hmm. that was more late 2000s. Mm-hmm. Walk me through, were you an Office fan from the beginning? Did you catch up on that later? Or
I was. I'd been a fan of the British Office, which now feels so unnecessary to say, but at the time, I mean, I remember, okay, great, they're adapting this very dark show. And season two of The Office, it just really hit its stride. I mean, I remember I feel like when you're adapting something, or, you know, and you're sort of beholden to the source material. So I feel like a lot of, you know, when Americans adapt, you know, British or European shows, there's this deference they pay in the first season that sometimes works and sometimes acts as a hindrance to the creativity or to its finding its own voice. And I feel like season two of The American Office is when it just let go of any sort of, you know, like, oh no, we need to worry about the British fans or worry about Ricky Gervais, and just thought, let's just make it about Michael Scott and, you know, this cast of misfits in Scranton, and that the George Foreman grilled the episode the injury the episode's called The Injury. It's one of the most absurd, torturous, like, half hours of television I've seen ever. It's so funny, it's so dark, it's, I mean, the exploration of compassion and empathy, amazing.
Well, it's weird in some ways to go back and watch it now, because it's, you know, he is such an awful boss.
He's so offensive on every level. It's just a nonstop stream of, like, classism, sexism, racism, ableism. I mean, you couldn't even list. I mean, he would just be out so quickly now.
Yeah.
But the thing is, also such a normal, like, you know, that is something that we are so used to. Even currently, we all still know a Michael Scott.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is, by season two, because you're right, season one, I think they were still trying to emulate David Brent, and they were still, like, trying to, he was even more cruel in season one, because that was much more sort of based on, I think they even used a lot of the scripts early on from the original Office and adapted them a little bit. So season two is when they started to soften him some, and it became much more of a family, and you started to get to know some of the other characters in the office. So he had started to become softer then, but he's still so awful. And, you know, what's interesting about that episode is Mindy Kaling wrote that episode. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she brought her interesting perspective to it as well. I mean, it's a disturbing episode, but it is a fun episode. You've got some good Dwight stuff as well, where, because he has a concussion, he briefly becomes a decent human being, but it's only momentary.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, for the first time, you see, like, shades of Michael Scott and Dwight, that where you realize, okay, these might be humans. These might be people who we feel a little bit of sympathy for.
The other thing I like, too, is that you see Pam really put upon, and, you know, they just treat Pam like shit, but she pushes back, and you start to see the glimmer of the Pam that we kind of, you know, really get to know and love in future seasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, you know, and I know a lot of people now who are going through, like, they're re-binging The Office now that it's, like, on Netflix, and people were watching from the beginning and, you know, going their way through. And it's, you know, it's one of those family, like office comedies that's also a workplace family, and you really appreciate it now, and you kind of miss it when it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, Angela, I rewatched it recently too, and Angela is one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so insane. She's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even in this episode, because she's got this like secret affair or crush with Dwight, and she's the one who's kind of still looking at the camera and is just like bitter over everything and sort of suspicious of everyone and everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. It's a great, like the fact that that show was on long enough that even the peripheral characters got enough personality and got enough airtime mm-hmm. is pretty cool.
I agree.
So, well, now on your favorite Portlandia episode, you also picked a sort of a departure from a regular Portlandia episode, mm-hmm. a rare instance of an episode devoted to one thing, which of course is the origin story of Tony and Candace.
Right. I guess I am exposing myself for the contrarian that I truly am.
But I like it. I mean, I like this episode for so many reasons. So this was season 5, episode 1, January 8, 2015 is when it aired. So take me back to this episode and the whole origins of the origin story, how you guys decided to do the whole Candace and Tony story.
Sometime around seasons 3 or 4 with Portlandia, we really realized we wanted to start focusing on characters. We used to sort of marry concepts or ideas with new characters. It felt like this sort of, you know, it's just this like bottomless, endless, you know, whatever, like pool of characters that we could draw from. And then we realized, no, there's actually only about 10 characters for whom we sort of feel this warmth towards, and we want to explore them deeper instead of just, you know, kind of reintroducing or introducing new characters. And kind of it felt like we were sort of keeping the audience at bay by doing that, and that it would be more interesting we get at something with a little more heart to kind of focus on a handful. Tony and Candace, who are feminist bookstore owners, had always been favorites of ours, and we realized, because they're so strange, you know, they operate from a place of outrage and contradiction, and so we thought, well, why, you know, why are these women who are running a feminist bookstore, which one would think would espouse, you know, solidarity and openness and inclusivity, why are they pushing people away? Mm-hmm. So we kept thinking, like, well, how did they meet? And at first we had them, we wanted them to maybe be the secret founders of this feminist punk movement called Riot Girl. We were like, oh, let's make it so that Tony and Candace were like the original Riot Girls. They were in this punk band. And then we thought, well, that's the expected thing, is that they came up through these earlier iterations.
Did they have their own band, or were they a part of the existing Riot Girl bands?
Yeah, that they were going to have their own band. Yeah. We were going to do this flashback that they, you know, had been in this punk scene. And we just thought, no, that's what people think, that they're going to be like part of the second or third wave feminist movement. And I thought, no, like, let's put them in a place that is just inherently more, like, full of more conflict. And so we put them in the corporate world that they had almost found, you know, and they were up against, you know, just rampant sexism and in their respective corporations, and sort of have to merge and join forces. But then the reason they find the bookstore is because they're basically escaping from the law,
right?
Which to me made so much more sense, because they always seemed like such sort of flawed, as a very flawed version of feminism, you know, very contradictory version of feminism, which is totally normal. I mean, humans are flawed and contradictory, but I just always wondered why they were so sort of mean. And so I wanted them to kind of come at it almost under duress and sort of learn, like, figure out a way of like operating in these new confines, mm-hmm. Which seemed to make more sense as a backstory. Like, why are they at such odds with their environment? And so, yeah, so we put them in this weird 80s corporate world, and We loved it. We had such a great time shooting that.
Yeah, yeah. And also it explains a little more of why they're at odds with each other as well. I mean, the whole backstory. And so many choices that you made in that episode. It's always fun to do flashbacks. Mm-hmm. So in 91, that's a fun year to go back to.
Yeah.
I mean, starting with the fact that they were working for two rival booksellers in B. Dalton and Walden Books, and the fact that you name-checked those two, I love. And then of course the dance off to Snaps the Power.
Yeah. Sorry. I just forgot about that dance off. And that's the thing. Like, we had to improvise that. That's, you know, I was like, why did we not try to choreograph that dance? It was really crazy.
Was that really just improv dancing?
That was improv dancing. That was a very fun day of dancing to that song. And we did not have a lot of money making that show. We really spent a lot of money on that song.
You mean Snaps the Power still is expensive?
Of course. It's a huge hit.
It was a huge hit. It's by the way, it's still a good song.
Doesn't come cheap, those hits.
I do still love that song to the point that I could rap you the rap, but I won't.
Feel free.
It's classic 90s. So that and also, you know, obviously there is this, you know, a serious story behind it, and you know, something that you guys have dealt with throughout the years on the show way before Me Too and Time's Up. It's of course watching it now in 2018 resonates at a whole different level. But what was the reaction to the episode? I mean, again, you guys were doing something different. How was it received from the fans and from folks?
I think it was received well. I feel like the general consensus was that we had done something surprising, and they were characters who people wanted to know on a deeper level and wanted to get a sense of, you know, their backstory and how they met. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky whenever, you know, people watch a show and sort of they want to know what's going to happen, but then they also want to be surprised. It's a really fine line to walk, and you really have to kind of tune out the sort of, like, you cannot create something based on consensus or based on, you know, what other people think or what their sort of external definitions are of the show. So I think we are always open to the elasticity of the form, and we're always just hoping that people would kind of come along for the ride. And I think that is an example of when we did it most successfully. Mm-hmm. I it didn't always work when we tried to, you know, be transgressive or subversive or, you know, do something that, you know, sort of defied people's expectations of the show. But I feel good that was a time that where it paid off.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it was, you know, a great tribute to those characters. And again, like you mentioned that, you know, how flawed they were. And is that, that's ultimately why the bookstore in real life just didn't quite understand what you guys are doing? Or there was a point where they wanted to move on and you guys went your separate ways? And
yeah, I think, you know, so in other words, it was a nonprofit, so they're run by an advisory board. And in the earlier iteration of the store and the board, everything was very copacetic, and we had a really great relationship with everyone that worked at the store and was, you know, part of the advisory committee. And then as that began to shift, I think sort of the newer wave of people just were less comfortable with sort of our version of, you know, what they saw on the show, what they saw with Tony and Candace, which is fine. You know, I mean, to me, I feel like the sort of noise and chatter around it was sort of distracting. But I think within politics, within feminist discourse, disagreeing is fine. Having a conversation that is about critique and, you know, is sort of giving out constructive criticism and not necessarily, you know, coming at it from the same perspective is okay. It's just when it kind of gets filtered through like this sort of, you know, clickbait outrage kind of lens that things feel really out of control. But when it really boils down to it, I'm like, great, you know, I respectfully disagree, but I also am a huge supporter of your bookstore. So we will We're going
to
be okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it in some ways allowed you to evolve Tony and Candace and sort of do the whole other stories and sort of take them apart, bring them back together. So, it opened the door inadvertently to more creativity.
Exactly. And I mean, in some ways, it was sort of the most fitting ending to us working at the bookstore that the actual bookstore would be offended and kick us out as when the sketch itself was about two people who were offended and were always kicking people out. It's like, well, you wrote a better ending than we could have.
I do still love the whole concept of this like local, like small, like free newspaper reporter showing up and just like writing a 50-word story about the women and women first and getting the whole life story of the two of them. So it was a great even setup to that whole episode.
All right, well, thanks.
So rest of your life, you're going to be asked the question about when does Portlandia come back? Are you getting ready for like the next 10 years of being asked that question until you finally bring it back?
I hadn't prepared for it, but now I will. I'll start bracing myself for it.
Every interview, I'm just going to tell you right now. So
that's so weird because there did not used to be that expectation for a television show. I mean, that was a common question for like a band.
Yeah.
You know, I think people should start asking divorced couples that. When are you guys getting back together?
Right.
You know, even if you've moved on and started new families and stuff.
Yeah, what about the reboot?
What is the reboot? What do you guys, come on.
Yeah, you know the fans are waiting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, listen, there are fans of couples.
Yeah.
Yeah, what if I was a fan of the old couple?
No, absolutely.
I never want to see them move on and do something new.
Yeah.
I always want them to do the old thing.
Yeah. Can you guys do the old tour? I mean, the Eagles, like, got back together and toured. How about you two?
Exactly.
Two crazy kids.
Yeah, so if, so if it could be more like that. No, I'm sure we'll do something, but I don't know. I mean, I feel like we ended in a way that we really still enjoyed it. It never felt like obligatory. It always felt hopeful and relatable and relevant. And I think we would only return to it if there was sort of something to say and that we felt like the container of Portlandia was sort of the only shape in which to tell a certain story. I think Fred and I and Jonathan Kreisel, our co-creator, we're all very allergic to anything that feels indulgent or self-referential. I love sort of getting in and getting out. And I would say 8 seasons is barely that. I mean, that's like a long stretch of time, and I feel so lucky to have done it for that long. So we'll see. I would say never say never, but who knows?
How is the pilot going, by the way?
It's good. It's done. Just in the waiting period now.
Yeah. So it's delivered.
It's delivered. Yeah.
Got it. And now we just kind of wait.
Just waiting. Everyone loves waiting.
Have they given you a timetable at all? Or
yes, I should know imminently. Really.
Yeah.
In like 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Like they could call you right now. Actually,
they could call me right now. I don't think they're going to.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how it works, where you get like a personal call. I wish it was like an Ed McMahon like thing where they just show up at your house with like a giant check and you like open the door and freak out.
Balloons.
Yeah.
And then a crew. Like then,
yeah,
then they're like
crew, yeah.
And then it's like you immediately start production.
Yeah.
Like that moment.
That's almost like a bad dream though. Is that like you just like, yeah, you open your door and you're just like action and then that's it. You just shoot 10 episodes and.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope there's a little more runway before that.
A fever dream of some sort. So we talked about your Hulu pilot, Search and Destroy. So that's fingers crossed. And what else are you excited about that you've got on your plate?
Doing some more directing. So I'm about to direct. A.D. Bryant has a new show called Shrill, which is based on a Lindy West's book. She's a cultural critic, humorist, and I'm about to go shoot an episode of that. And I have some more directing. I just did some recording with Slater Kinney. I'm really honestly trying to, this neologism is not a great one, but monotask. It's just really about trying to be in the moment and to enjoy something. And ideally, it's not just enjoying work, it's enjoying anything, but I really am trying to sort of do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And do it with intention and dedication. And love, which I think you can only do if you're not spreading yourself thin. So, one step at a time, one project at a time, one, you know, day at a time.
Well, congrats on the Emmy nominations.
Thank you.
So one final visit with the Portlandia folks. So good luck.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to everything else. Thank you, Carrie Brownstein. Great seeing you.
You too.
And that's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.